and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the debriefing of an Islamic State fighter from Germany, Harry Safo, who was trained in Syria by EMNI, the intelligence arm of ISIS, to return to Europe and kill as many people as possible. His story is featured extensively in Thursday's New York Times, and we will speak with Dr. John Mueller, a senior fellow at the Cato Institute and a professor of political science at Ohio State University, who has an article at Reason magazine, ISIS Isn't an Existential Threat to America, Why Politicians Shouldn't Overestimate the Terror Group's Power. We will discuss how the would-be terrorist trainers see America as an easy target. Quote, it's much easier to get them over the social network because they say Americans are dumb. They have open gun policies. We can radicalize them easily. They can buy guns. Then we will speak with Ian Millhiser, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress Action Fund and an editor of Think Progress, where he has an article, If Trump Drops Out, the Result Will Be a Horrible Legal Quagmire. We will discuss what the RNC can do if Trump quits, but if he does so after the ballot deadlines, it gets complicated. Then more so if it comes down to the Electoral College making the choice, or even more so if the lame duck Republican-dominated House of Representatives gets to decide who the next president is. Then finally, we will discuss the latest report released by Election Protection, the nation's largest nonpartisan voter protection coalition, the 2016 primaries in review. The author of the report, Jennifer Patin, a writer and editor at the Voting Rights Project of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, joins us to discuss what citizens in the states no longer protected by the Voting Rights Act can do to exercise their rights as American citizens in the face of concerted efforts to suppress their votes, many of which federal courts recently struck down as flagrantly targeting minority voters with, quote, surgical precision. And joining us now is Dr. John Mueller, who's a senior fellow at the Cato Institute and a political scientist at Ohio State University. His books include Atomic Obsession, Nuclear Alarmism from Hiroshima to Al-Qaeda, Terror Security and Money, Balancing the Risks, Benefits and Costs of Homeland Security, War and Ideas, Selected Essays, and his latest is Chasing Ghosts, The Policing of Terrorism. And he has an article at Reason magazine, ISIS Isn't an Existential Threat to America, Why Politicians Shouldn't Overestimate the Terror Group's Power. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. John Mueller.
Thanks. Great to be here again.
And John, there's an extensive article in Thursday's New York Times where a jihadi from Germany, a character called Harry Safo, who went down from Bremen in Germany all the way down to Syria to join the Islamic State. And no sooner had he got there to meet with the Islamic State, their intelligence unit grabbed him and said, we want you to turn around and go back to Germany because you're a lot better off to us in Germany where you can attack these soft targets. And apparently this has been the case with a number of these recruits from France, England, Germany, Austria, etc. So what did you make of this fairly extensive debriefing of this character who's in jail in Germany?
Well, remind me a lot of what we heard for 10 years about Al-Qaeda, how they had all these spooky networks and how they were basically under our bed and coming at us and so forth. Since 9/11, Al-Qaeda was incapable of infiltrating a single operative into the United States. Even though the United States admits about 300 million foreigners legally every year. And so there is a huge amount of spouting about how you have to be really, you know, we're out to get you and so forth. And it came to remarkably little. It didn't come to nothing. It's not that nothing ever happened, but it was awfully, very substantially limited. And the more they talked, the more it was easy to spot them as well. So it seems to me there's the same sort of spin going on. ISIS is in incredibly bad shape. It's falling apart in the Middle East. It's even seeming to make plans to accept the point that they're going to have to be a virtual state because they're going to lose everything in territorially. That may or may not happen soon, but it's unlikely to happen soon, but it may happen in time. And so they've got this sort of boneheaded idea that they should just sort of blow things up as if somehow that's going to improve the situation and keep people remembering them. It'll certainly definitely keep people remembering them, but it doesn't do any good for their cause, clearly. So mostly what they've done in Europe is they've been sort of inspirational. Now, as much of what's happened in Europe and in the United States is not by anybody that's really been in contact in any meaningful sense with ISIS, much less a member of it, but is sort of inspired by the notion. And that is also very much in decline. In 2014, there were about two or three cases in the United States in which people were thinking, or either did or were thinking, or arrested for plotting terrorism. That went up to about 19 in 2015, a huge number, during sort of ISIS's heyday, and many of those were inspired by ISIS. And in 2016, this year, there's only been two, one of which, however, was Orlando. But these are not because they're connected to anybody, because they're ordering anybody, but because people just sort of inspired, many of them, of course, of questionable mental stability.
But nevertheless, as the article points out, the attacks in France, where they slaughtered all of the concert goers, etc., those were planned in Syria, and the mastermind was a part of, I believe, this ISIS intelligence group called EMNI. And the Paris attacks, the attacks in Tunisia, the recent mowing down of all those people with an 18-wheeler truck in Nice. At the end of the day, either these people...
Yeah, but you're putting two things together. So some of those attacks were definitely connected in a fairly meaningful sense, meaning the Paris and the Brussels case. Mm. But the Nice thing didn't have any connection at all. This guy just basically had this idea and mumbled about it when he was going through this rampage.
Right.
So those are two different things, the inspiration and actually this so-called network that they've got going.
Right.
By the way, the best evidence on this, people have been studying it, and this is not a precise number by any means, about the number of returnees from the Middle East that go back to Europe that then commit or try to commit terrorism, about 1 in 100. So that's not zero, obviously, which is the preferred number, but it doesn't present a massive threat. Not that any death from is tragic, but it doesn't represent something that's going to be an upheaval to society.
Well, my understanding, though, is that the Islamic State did take credit for Nice, whether this guy was a last-minute convert or not.
Yeah, well, this guy mumbled the thing, so they're taking credit for things they don't know anything about. They took credit for Brussels, and they obviously had no connection to it in terms of actual planning, because they were. Some of the early reporting says they're using a lot of guns, and they repeated that. These guys are using guns, and it turns out the early reporting was wrong. In other words, they're just regurgitating press releases or things they saw in the Western press. They're not taking credit, oddly enough, for the attack on Istanbul. A little bit hard to figure out why. And the attacks have been just overwhelmingly counterproductive to their case, including, obviously, the ones in Paris. They simply make people madder and madder. They've turned Turkey against them. They turned Syria against them. They turned, obviously, the United States and Western Europe against them, and France big time. And so it's basically a mindless game that they think somehow is required by God knows what. They're basically doomed overall. But this does not mean I'm not arguing they're incapable of committing some disasters. But it's a very limited kind of concern. If you take everybody who was killed by terrorism in 2015, the worst year, the year of Paris and so forth, and assume all of them were inspired by or ISIS connected and so forth, the total number of people killed by terrorists in Europe last year, 2015, was much smaller than it was in almost any year in the 1970s and the 1980s, when the concern was particularly the Irish Republican Army and the ETA, secessionist movement in Spain, and as well as some others. So that should keep it in some context, even at their worst. They're still not committing damage that was as big as Europe has suffered through and survived very handily from the 70s and 80s.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. John Mueller, who's a senior fellow at the Cato Institute and a professor of political science at Ohio State University. His latest book is Chasing Ghosts, The Policing of Terrorism, and he has an article at Reason Magazine, ISIS Isn't an Existential Threat to America, Why Politicians Shouldn't Overestimate the Terror Group's Power. And we're talking about the very, very extensive article in Thursday's New York Times, where Harry Safo, a former Islamic State fighter from Germany, who's in a maximum security prison in Bremen, Germany, was interviewed by the New York Times. And you mentioned getting guns. The quote that I found extraordinary from this Harry Safo character is, because he was asked, when he was recruited down there by the so-called intelligence group of the Islamic State, he said, we want you to go back to Germany. And he said, what about France? And they said, they laughed and said, we got France covered. We've got plenty of people there. What about America? Well, for America, this is a quote, for America and Canada, it's much easier for them to get them over the social network because they say the Americans are dumb. They have open gun policies. They say we can radicalize them easily. And if they had no prior record, they can buy guns. So we don't need to have no contact man who has to provide guns for them. That's it's pretty chilling, isn't it? When you know.
Well, that's just the usual thing about the comparative availability of a very effective way for killing people, guns. Mm-hmm. It's not a commentary on their capacity or anything. Or somehow it's all confused in that quote.
Right.
They're easier to inspire or not. And I just gave you some of the data. Basically,
sure.
There were a lot of inspirees who tried to do something, mostly, by the way, not with guns, but with knives in the United States in 2015. And there's been far less since.
But it is a comment on us as a society, surely. If recently the House went on strike in a sit-down protest to try and stop the NRA's power over the House Republicans to allow for a modest change, which is that people on the terrorist fly list can't buy firearms, and that failed. But this guy's saying, the great thing about America is you don't have to have criminal underground people to supply you with guns. You can just go buy them openly. Surely that's more of a comment on us, not how...
That's a comment on the ability to buy guns in the United States.
Exactly.
Yeah,
sure.
That obviously apply to criminals and others as well.
Sure. So in terms, though, of, obviously the threat's been exaggerated, a vast bureaucracy, billions of dollars have gone into all of these consultancies and all of these massive...
Well, let's not leave the press out.
The New
York Times plasters this. I don't know if it's in the Western edition or whatever, but it is the one I've got. Plasters it all over the first page. Why did they do that? Is that such a big story?
Mm-hmm.
It's because it sells newspapers. James Rise in the New York Times has pointed out many times, fear sells, and he's working for a company that does it as much as pretty much anybody else. They should really take. They also had a publication. They also had an editorial just last week or two, basically saying that the fact that ISIS is going down the tubes is basically no relevance because they are simply it does not demonstrate desperation and weakness, but it demonstrates strength and long-time survival skills. If you can publish something that scares the hell out of people and they already are scared, you're going to sell well. And that it is selling extremely well. There's a survey that was out done just about 4 months ago asking whether ISIS presents a great danger to America's survival or existence. And of those who were asked, 77% said yes.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, you've got a willing audience, and if you try to undercut that, you're not going to sell nearly as many newspapers as if you play to those fears of your patrons.
Well, but let's talk about who else benefits from this hysteria. You said your article at Reason Magazine, ISIS isn't an existential threat to America. Quote, this is the relevant bit. Why politicians shouldn't overestimate the terror group's power. Well, we know that Donald Trump is essentially running on that he can take care of ISIS better.
Right.
We know that he's tumbling in the polls and he may even have to pull out or they're, you know, it's just a, it's a continuing train wreck. But the one thing that could rescue him from oblivion, politically speaking, is an ISIS attack. And the guy down in Orlando, he pledged allegiance to ISIS, etc. What happened after he shot up all those people in the nightclub? The sales of guns go up. So
right.
It's as I mentioned, the terrorism industrial complex keeps, the gravy keeps flowing from the treasury. So there are a lot of people who live off this hysteria, but I guess you're trying to cut through it, right? And trying to put it in a context.
With almost no impact. I wrote a book in 2006 saying that the whole threat of terrorism was overblown, that Al-Qaeda was not a cosmic threat, that it did not threaten the future of the world, that it was not going to get nuclear weapons and so forth, and no one believed me. But the people who said the opposite are the ones who pop up on CNN and everything else, because hysteria sells. If you can get people, you can weave the phrase ISIS into any story, even about how to cook peanut butter or something, you're likely to get a lot more attention. So there's been a strong tendency to do that.
Well, the one thing that presumably one could do something about, if we lived in a rational world here, would be that gun sales go up like crazy after mass shootings. That benefits the gun and ammunition manufacturers. And this quote that from this terrorist being debriefed in Germany indicates that the Islamic State tells their people, you don't need to bring guns. By the way, when they first routed the Taliban in Afghanistan, they found the Taliban handbook, the Al-Qaeda handbook that said, if you're going to do jihad in America, for God's sake, don't bring guns in. You can buy them there. And this is what this character has also said.
Al-Qaeda has done no jihad within the United States since 2001.
Right, but still, there have
been... They only get one person in, so they couldn't even find somebody to pull the trigger.
Right, but
they have done some inspiration.
Sure, but the people who have done mass shootings here in the name of these terrorist groups, and the Orlando guy, the one down in Tennessee, etc., they do get firearms, and they get, you know, military-style firearms. And so I was going to say, the only thing that, if you've been ignored in terms of trying to put this into proportion, then the one area where perhaps some change can happen, notwithstanding the failure of the Democrats' sit-down in the House, would be in terms of gun control. In other words, if you can't stop Americans from being paranoid, at least you're going to...
If you could guarantee me that gun control would do much good at all with murder or anything else, I'd be on very much on your side. Mm-hmm. As far as I can see, it basically doesn't do very much, and it's also a hopeless endeavor in the sense that there's so many guns in this country that controlling them, even if you really had a dedicated effort, is a hopeless cause. Mm-hmm. Furthermore, as the guy with the truck showed us, there's an awful lot of other ways to kill people, and they'll discover them as well.
So, without...
It's not about guns.
Sure.
It's about desire to kill people, mainly.
Right. And
also, the gun sales going up. I mean, you know, I as far as I'm concerned, if every gun in the world vanished, I'd be perfectly happy. I've never understood why anyone wanted to hunt and stuff like that. I'm not exactly an enthusiast, you might say. Mm-hmm. I don't even know how to spell NRA, practically. You know, if you read about Orlando and so forth, those guys were in there and they're being shot at, and they had no defense. Do I want to be in there or in a movie theater in Colorado or any place where somebody jumps on the stage and starts shooting, and all I can do at best is hope that he'll miss? Or do I want to have a gun and shoot back? That's the mentality. I don't think it's necessarily a wise one and so forth, but that's one of the reasons that I would need guns to protect myself. That inspires that sort of feeling big time, from my standpoint, quite unfortunately, but nonetheless.
Right, but the guy that we mentioned earlier running for president, who's essentially only platform so far that is that he's going to take care of ISIS better. He also said he could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue, and he's boasted about the fact that he has a concealed carry license. So, just in closing, though, John,
yeah, does Donald Trump and Donald Trump carry a gun? No, I'm really scared.
Exactly. So, just in closing, without leaving the audience with total despair that nothing can be done. Obviously, it's an exaggerated threat. People are living off the fat of the land off this excessive paranoia, and the only beneficiaries are those that's in the media who sell the newspapers and eyeballs, and the gun people benefit every time there's a mass shooting, and of course the terrorism industrial complex continues to shake down the treasury. What is your recommendation to the average American? Stop being afraid?
Yes. And that's an exercise in futility. The number of people who are killed by Islamist extremists in the United States since 9/11 is about 7 per year. People sure should know that number, 7 per year. Your chance of being killed is about 1 in 20 million per year, if you want to put it in those terms. I once recommended to a guy at CNN, you know, I have this crawl going across, you know, all the time when you do a terrorism case, a CNN crawl of news and stuff. Why don't you insert in there an American's chance of being killed by a terrorist in any given year is 1 in 20 million. And he was unmoved, shall we say. Basically, what's impressive is the Democrats are trying to deal with this problem, which is dangerous for their from their standpoint, because Trump is going to trump them on a ferociousness about the threat. And they're basically ignoring it. They're hoping it'll go away. And maybe that's maybe that'll work. But, you know, they gave this convention that was filled with moonbeams by comparison. Joe Biden denied that the problem was there. He denied that 77% think that ISIS is a threat to the United States. It's existential and to our survival. Saying we never fear, we never back down, we never cower. When what we should probably be doing is thinking about changing the last word in the Star Spangled Banner. Then other people said, well, Hillary has a plan, and Hillary said she had a plan, and she mentioned a little bit in her speech, and it was three items which sort of suggested either she or whoever wrote her speech doesn't have the foggiest idea about what's going on in the Middle East. And that, in fact, what's happening in the Middle East is ISIS is on the run, it's falling apart, it is a vicious group, it's not a cosmic threat. We want to keep going after that. The Obama policy is basically working, I think, really quite well. It's a matter of policing. We should encourage Twitter use, because the more those knuckleheads use Twitter and other communication, the more likely they are to be found. And the police are doing a pretty good job in that respect. But what you shouldn't expect is there's going to be perfection. No police chief comes in and says, I'm going to cure crime. We're going to have zero murders next year after I get in. But we seem to expect that the president should be able to do that with terrorism, and that's absurd.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Dr. John Mueller.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. John Mueller, who's a senior fellow at the Cato Institute and a professor of political science at Ohio State University. His latest book is Chasing Ghosts, The Policing of Terrorism, and he has an article at Reason Magazine, ISIS Isn't an Existential Threat to America, Why Politicians Shouldn't Overestimate the Terror Group's Power. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the increasingly complicated scenarios that would follow if Donald Trump drops out of the presidential race. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Ian Millhiser, who's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress Action Fund and the editor of Think Progress Justice. He is the author of Injustices, the Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted. And he has an article at Think Progress, If Trump Drops Out, the Result Will Be a Horrific Legal Quagmire. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ian Millhiser.
Good to be here. Thanks so much.
And Ian, this scenario of Trump dropping out is something I've been following for several months. And obviously it's speculative, to say the least.
Right.
But now it's starting to get a lot of coverage in the press, and there's even some suggestions that a number of Republicans might be trying to organize an intervention to stop Trump's serial self-destruction. But I take it that if there were to be anybody to replace him, assuming that he does decide to throw up his arms and quit to avoid the humiliation of a massive defeat, would they have to reconvene another convention very quickly? Isn't the clock ticking on ballot deadlines in various states?
Right. So, I mean, there's a bunch of issues here. I mean, the possibility, you know, I should specify that we're talking about a very unlikely hypothetical, because the only real way for Trump to get removed as the GOP's nominee, is unless he dies, is that he would have to voluntarily relinquish that, and that's just not something that he's particularly likely to do. If he were to relinquish the nomination, from the party's perspective, it's fairly clear what happened. The RNC and its members are allowed to substitute a new nominee if the current nominee decides that they don't want to run anymore. So that's the easy part. The hard part is that it opens up a tremendous quagmire where you have a number, you know, states have different rules for who has the access to the ballot. They have different rules for when someone can drop out. And just because someone drops out doesn't necessarily mean that their line on the ballot gets replaced by someone else. They have different rules which are of somewhat doubtful constitutionality, so it's not clear how these would play out. But they have different rules governing what the members of the Electoral College who actually pick the president have to do and who they would have to vote for if a particular candidate were to drop out. So my point is that if, in fact, a major party nominee were to leave, it would set off some serious chaos, because a lot of states wouldn't know what to do with their ballots. A lot of electors might not know what to do with their votes. And we could potentially have a situation where, you know, the states don't know what to put on the ballots and no one knows who to vote for.
Well, also, wouldn't Ted Cruz, who had the second biggest number of delegates, and John Kasich, wouldn't they want to sort of reconvene? And now that by that point, the delegates, Trump delegates would be unbound, to say the least.
Right.
So how would that scenario play out? And of course, Pence would be saying, wait a minute, I'm the guy, wouldn't it?
Right. So it wouldn't be the delegates who would decide. Like the delegates, became like once the convention adjourned, the delegates became ordinary citizens again. It would be the members of the Republican National Committee who would decide, and those would be the people that Pence and Cruz and Kasich and all those folks would have to lobby to try to get the party to pick them as the new nominee. I mean, I said that's a fairly simple process, and by that I mean it's fairly clear who gets to make that choice. But in reality, you're right, that would also create a tremendous amount of uncertainty, because bear in mind how Donald Trump got to be the nominee. You know, the majority of Republican primary voters did not vote for Donald Trump. They voted for one of the 16 other candidates. But the party doesn't have its act together. The establishment hates Ted Cruz possibly even more than they hate Donald Trump. The Cruz faction thinks that everyone else in the party is a bunch of weak-knee sellouts. And if Trump were to suddenly remove himself, all of these intra-party tensions would not go away. And so you could potentially have a situation where the RNC delegate couldn't decide on who their replacement is to be.
So this comes down then to the ultimate power of Reince Priebus, that because the party's internal rules permit the RNC to, quote, fill any and all vacancies which may occur by reason of death, declination, or otherwise of the Republican candidate for president of the United States. That is the binding legal basis, right?
Right. Well, so Priebus is the chair of the RNC, so that gives him, you know, some administrative control, and it gives him the power to actually chair the meetings. But the Republican National Committee is a committee. I mean, there are many people, and Priebus gets a vote, but he would not have the unilateral authority to pick in the event that the nomination became vacant. He would not have the authority to simply unilaterally say, okay, this person is now a presidential nominee. It's something that the full committee would have to decide on. And that's where the potential for chaos comes in there, is that some members of the committee are probably in the Cruz faction. Some of them think that Cruz is anathema. And even amongst the people who are relatively similarly minded, Scott Walker's going to have a faction. Paul Ryan's going to have a faction. It would be entertaining to watch to see these folks try to come around and decide who the nominee should be given those circumstances.
But they wouldn't televise this in a million years, would they?
I mean, I doubt very much they'd want to have cameras in the room. I mean, and even if they had cameras in the room for the final meeting where they tried to get this all resolved, a lot of it, I mean, any kind of dealing like that is going to happen behind closed doors. It's going to be, and there's not necessarily anything wrong with that. I mean, it would be loyalists for one candidate taking committee members out to a few drinks and feeling them out and trying to get them on board. It would be a lot of private phone conversations, and who knows what would emerge from the process. It would be messy, and a lot of reporters would probably cut their teeth, figuring out the day by day details as to how this is playing out. And as it was playing out, meanwhile, the days would be ticking down to the election. With each day that passes, that's less time for whoever the nominee is to campaign. And even if they settle on that one, the closer they are to the election, the more likely it is that many state laws are say, sorry, you don't get to put that guy on the ballot.
And again, I'm speaking with Ian Millhiser, who's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress's Action Fund and the editor of Think Progress Justice. He's the author of Injustices, the Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted. And he has an article at Think Progress, If Trump Drops Out, the Result Will Be a Horrible Legal Quagmire. So clearly, again, you get back to the running out of time to get people's names on the ballot, although I do recall that Ross Perot, I think he dropped out, maybe it was in July, and then he came back later, I think in October. I don't know what happened vis-a-vis his name. I guess it was already on the ballot. But
yeah, I mean, as I recall, Perot was a candidate at one point, and then he stopped campaigning. But I don't know if he ever actually formally filed the paperwork to withdraw and then tried to unwithdraw, which in many states would be quite difficult. Mm-hmm. Again, it varies. There's 51 jurisdictions because the District of Columbia gets to vote on the president as well. Each one of them is going to have unique rules, and sometimes those rules can be really unforgiving. I mean, to give you an example of how unforgiving, in 2000, Mel Carnahan was the governor of Missouri. He was running for the U.S. Senate seat occupied at the time by John Ashcroft. And 3 weeks before the election, Carnahan died in a plane crash. The ballots had already been printed. The state wouldn't allow the party to substitute someone else as the replacement candidate for the late governor. And so we wound up having an election between a dead guy and a live John Ashcroft. Now, the punchline to this story is that the dead guy beat John Ashcroft, which is why Ashcroft was unemployed when Bush asked him to be the attorney general. The new governor wound up appointing Carnahan's wife to fill the seat. But, that's how unforgiving those laws can be. I mean, in that case, someone died. It was, it wasn't like they did anything wrong or they were delinquent and forgot to fill out paperwork. There was a terrible tragedy. Mm-hmm. And the state looked at this law and said, tough, Democrats, you're going to have to run the dead guy.
So the reason, though, that we're speculating about the possibility of Trump dropping out is that on many occasions, and just in the last few days in particular, he has talked about how the election is rigged. Now, you can interpret that many ways, and some people in the press are interpreting it as he's laying the groundwork either to quit or to delegitimize the winner. What do you think is going on with Trump's continual signaling to his followers that the game is rigged? If you're running for something in a race and the game is rigged, why continue to run?
Well, I mean, this has been the Republicans' part, the Republican Party strategy. I mean, Trump has taken it to a whole nother level, but it's been their strategy for a really long time. I mean, how much have you heard about voter fraud and how we need to have all these laws that make it much harder to vote in order to combat voter fraud? You know, the reality is that the type of voter fraud that these laws supposedly target, which is voter fraud that occurs at the polls where someone tries to impersonate someone else, that kind of voter fraud is virtually non-existent. I mean, it is slightly more common than unicorns. And there have been all kinds of studies. There's even investigations led by Republican elected officials who support voter ID, and they go looking for a case of in-person voter fraud, and they can't find it. There's a Supreme Court case dealing with these voter ID laws that are supposedly to fight this kind of voter fraud, and it was only able to find one example of in-person voter fraud in 140 years. So it's a problem that doesn't really exist. And yet we're being told that this is this crippling thing that's happening, and that people are trying to steal elections, and that we need these laws which actually rig elections in order to prevent this imaginary problem from rigging elections. I mean, if that is the rhetoric that your party has been relying on for years, for more than a decade, we've been hearing about these phantoms of voter fraud that are coming to take away our fair elections. If that is what you've been selling the voters, then it's not much of a leap to get to what Donald Trump is saying, where here we are months before the election actually takes place. The polls show him, at least, in the immediate wake of the conventions, to be tanking, and Hillary Clinton to be a strong front runner. And he's right now just saying, oh, it's rigged. I mean, it's very dangerous for him to say this, because if he loses, which looks likely right now, there could be a lot of very angry people with guns who feel like they've been cheated here. But it's not an unusual tactic by any means for a Republican candidate to get up and say things that aren't true about election rigging.
Well, also, they've they delegitimized or tried to delegitimize Bill Clinton because Ross Perot took 19% of the vote and Bill Clinton didn't get past 50%. But then again, Obama got over 50% in both elections, and they did try to delegitimize him, and Trump was one of their leading delegitimizers, if you will, with this Bertha nonsense, which was a way to suggest that somehow this guy was from Kenya and he's an interloper and he wasn't an American, and therefore he's not a legitimate president. So that is an old sore. I get that part. But the second part of what you just told us, though, Ian Millhiser, is quite chilling, because there's no question that Donald Trump has attracted a lot of white supremacists and nationalists and gun-toting right-wing populists. He's quite popular with that constituency, and David Duke's a huge supporter of Donald Trump, and Trump has been less than categorical in repudiating that kind of support from that sector. So that's could be a huge problem, surely, if he goes and says that the game is rigged and I lost because crooked Hillary cheated. These characters could get up to something, surely.
Yeah, and that is, that is a risk. I mean, I don't know if it's like, I don't necessarily think we are going to have mass unrest. But, as we saw with the Bundy militia recently, a handful of cranks can potentially cause a lot of damage. It might be localized damage, but it can be harmful. It can potentially be fatal. And so, yes, I mean, he is playing with a very dangerous form of fire right now. You know, the tradition in this country, Brian Beutler had a very good piece in the New Republic today making this point that one of our most important traditions is the concession speech that candidates give after they lose. And it is a way of signaling, okay, we've had our election. We are now going to have a peaceful transition of power. And, you know, this result, regardless of whether you are happy with it, is a legitimate result. And the person who won is our legitimate leader. And, you know, if Trump decides that he wants to start tearing down that norm and tearing down that understanding, it can lead to, you know, some very dark kinds of civil unrest that I don't think are going to threaten the United States government, but it could lead to a lot of people being in some very unsafe situations.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, let's talk about the Electoral College, because that's where who ultimately elect the president. It's this antiquated group of electors that are chosen,
right.
And that some of them are not necessarily bound. They call them faithless electors.
Right.
They meet, I think, sometime in December after the election. And the 12th Amendment provides that the electors shall meet in their respective states and vote by ballot for president and vice president. But it doesn't specifically say they have to, who they have to vote for. So is there a way out there for the Republicans?
I mean, there is a possibility. I mean, so, it's a dumb way of picking a president. We don't actually literally vote for the president. We vote for these electors who then themselves vote for who the president is going to be. It's a good question whether or not these electors would be allowed to screw around like that. A lot of states have what are called faithless electors laws, which, you know, take some sort of, which either like force them to step down if they don't vote for the person who won the state, or potentially fines them if they don't vote for the person. And so, you know, there are laws prohibiting these electors from not doing what their state told them to do. The problem is I'm not sure if those laws are constitutional, because the Constitution says it's the electors who get to pick the president, not the state lawmakers who wrote those faithless elector laws. So, you know, if the Republicans wanted to play games, they could try to convince the electors to choose someone else if Donald Trump wins. And, you know, and then we get to find out whether or not those statutes are constitutional or not. The biggest danger you have with that sort of game, though, is like, then there is something fundamentally illegit. I mean, that actually would be rigging an election. If you can want Donald Trump to be president or not, but if the people choose Donald Trump, and then a group of Republican loyalists get together in a meeting and say, you know what, like, yeah, they just voted for Donald Trump, but we actually would rather have Paul Ryan, and so we're going to pick him instead. Like, that actually is a rigged system. Like, there's no way to spin that.
Right.
And so, you know, all the possibilities of civil unrest that I discussed earlier become grossly magnified, because in that situation, the allegation that the system was rigged would actually be accurate. I think that the circumstance where the Electoral College would have the strongest claim to legitimacy is if Trump actually did drop out. Like, you know, if he said, I don't want this job. Give it to someone else. And despite that fact, Republicans still won the presidential election without it being clear who their candidate was. And then the Electoral College met, and they had a mandate to pick a Republican, but the Republican whose name was actually on the ballot didn't want it. I mean, in that circumstance, I think the Electoral College would have some degree of legitimacy to say, well, you know, the only thing we know is that we got to pick a Republican, so let's pick Paul Ryan. And so they could do that. You know, the other thing that they could do is they could pick no one, and if they pick no one, it goes to the House, and the House could pick no one. And then on election day or on inauguration day, Mike Pence would still be sworn in as vice president, and there'd be a vacancy in the presidency, so he'd automatically assume the presidency.
Well, you've given us a lot to think about, and I thank you for joining us, Ian Millhiser.
All right, thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Ian Millhiser, who's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress Action Fund and the editor of Think Progress Justice. He's the author of Injustices, the Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted. And he has an article at Think Progress. If Trump drops out, the results will be a horrific legal quagmire. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back to look into the latest report released by Election Protection, the 2016 primaries in review. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Jennifer Patin, who is a writer and editor of the Voting Rights Project of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law's latest report, the 2016 Primaries in Review, released by Election Protection, the nation's largest nonpartisan voter protection coalition. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jennifer Patin.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And a lot of people have been concerned about people not being able to vote in this country. There's been a number of, since the Voting Rights Act was struck down by the Supreme Court, at least Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act was struck down by the Supreme Court. Almost immediately, a number of states that previously had required preclearance brought in some rather restrictive voting rights laws, which just in the last week or two have been struck down in North Carolina, in Texas, Kansas, and in Wisconsin. Of course, North Carolina and Wisconsin being key swing states. So I take it that there's a sense amongst people, particularly those who on the Democratic side and minority voters who were concerned that they wouldn't be able to vote in this election, there's a considerable sigh of relief. But I take it from your report that there's still a lot more work to be done, that the problem has hardly been solved by these recent court decisions.
Right. Two things about that. So the recent court decisions are absolutely victories, and voting rights advocates are celebrating right now. But it also means that the rules are changing, right? So, you know, in Texas, a voter who had to show one of seven forms of photo ID on March 1st for the primary will have different rules on November 8th. So poll workers need to be informed of that, and so do voters. So with these victories, there's also a lot of poll worker training that needs to be done, as well as voter education that needs to be done. So that's one thing. And then the other is, yes, there is more work to do beyond the court victories. You know, a lot of it comes down to better election administration planning on behalf of election officials so that they are prepared for some of the inevitable problems that are going to happen on election day. For example, in Alabama and in Texas, the websites that have the polling place locators on them went down. And it was incredibly hard for voters to look for their polling place, but it was also hard for election protection volunteers to help voters. You know, that's something that election officials can capacity test before the November elections. They can make sure that their websites can handle a certain amount of people coming on to look for their polling place. And some of those things can be prevented.
So tell us about Election Protection, the nation's largest nonpartisan voter protection coalition, which is led by your organization, Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law.
Sure. Election Protection runs a series of programs in election years. We train field volunteers to help on the ground during elections. We operate national voter protection hotlines. So the Lawyers Committee runs 866-OUR-VOTE. Naleo Educational Fund does 888-VEI-VOTA. And Asian Pacific Islander Votes and AAJC runs the third one for Asian American Languages. So we do those three national hotlines. Also train legal volunteers, people that come in and they answer the calls on the call centers and help voters figure out how to exercise their right to vote. We also collect data and report stories like in this report. And voter education and trainings around the country, for instance, in a lot of states, there's been different things going on with laws that affect people with prior felony convictions. We do trainings in Kentucky, for instance, to help people know what are your next steps? How can you get your right to vote back?
And again, I'm speaking with Jennifer Patin, who is a writer and editor of the Voting Rights Project of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law's latest report, the 2016 Primaries in Review, released by Election Protection, the nation's largest nonpartisan voter protection coalition. So let's dig into the report, Jennifer. The report highlights voting problems and litigation updates in 10 states, as well as the personal stories of voters from Georgia, North Carolina, and Texas. So let's focus on Georgia, because there was a New York Times story recently that indicated that there were some sort of Jim Crow-type laws that still exist, where the sheriff would come by and to a small rural community and tell people that they have to show up in court in order to vote. So that it would be very much in the category of something that needs to be fixed, as opposed to celebrating the recent court rulings with North Carolina and Texas. So tell us more about how you did the report and what you learned from people themselves.
Well, whenever a caller calls 866-OUR-VOTE, one of our election protection volunteers logs the description of their problem or question in our system. So I went through our system and I looked at issues that were pervasive, like affected multiple voters in a polling place, or stories that I thought really told how hard it can be to cast a ballot in this country. I identified a group of voters that I wanted to speak to personally, and with the help of a volunteer and an undergraduate intern, we called those voters and really found out, we dug deep into their stories, found out how it felt, you know, when they struggled to cast their ballot and finally cast it. We talked to volunteers to know how they felt about volunteering and helping someone to exercise their right to vote. We got permission to share their stories, and I really wanted to just put a human face to everything this year, because we hear a lot of stories about the litigation and restoring the Voting Rights Act, but really it's real people that are affected by these laws and by these practices.
But since much of these problems occur on election day itself, particularly if there's a shortage of ballots or if there's a big long line because they don't have enough people or enough machines, etc., then if you're on the phone to these people, and I'm sure other people are on the phone to them as well, and that's the only day that they're all working, a lot of people may slip through the cracks. Is there any way that there is a more proactive way to do this? I'm not putting this on your shoulders. I'm just saying, as a nation in general, it seems like we have really ridiculous, restrictive, cumbersome, and unnecessarily difficult procedures. Is there any way to be proactive, for example, make sure that that there's enough ballots or there's a surplus of ballots? Is there anything you can do in that direction?
Well, we absolutely encourage that. And one of the recommendations we make in the report is for election officials for Secretary of State and election officials to start working together to produce election administration plans. Ohio is a good example. There was pervasive problems, just extensive problems in the Ohio 2004 election. And as a result, there was a lawsuit. And the settlement of that lawsuit in 2009 was for Ohio counties to start developing and submitting to the Secretary of State these election administration plans that kind of, try to prepare for everything. And there's no way you can prepare for everything, but if with proper planning, you can help less voters slip through the cracks. And I think what we're seeing is that, states just aren't quite prepared for the problems that can happen. They don't think about them beforehand. But with the proper planning, it's more likely that they can address some of these things.
Well, we all remember the butterfly ballots down in Florida. So there's a sort of expectation that things don't necessarily go right. But just so that our listeners, the last thing you want is to turn people off from voting because, you know, the system doesn't work and it sort of spreads despair. So what can people do, knowing, for example, in these southern states that used to be covered by Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, and even here in California, I had problems voting, had to vote with a provisional ballot in the primaries. So given that the system is flawed throughout the country, what can citizens do, apart from the work that you do? What can average citizens do?
Right. Well, I mean, you know, it's a shame that with the loss of Section 5 protections, the burden really is on the voter right now. Election officials should be doing everything they can to explain to voters and to include voters in processes. But apart from that, voters can make plans to vote. They can make sure they're registered. They can make sure they know how they're going to get to the polls. They can check their polling place a few days before the election. They can make sure they know what kind of ID they need to bring to the polls and just really get prepared to vote. And not only that, but, you know, kind of linking voting to everything that goes on in their lives. The decisions that their school board makes, well, oftentimes school board members are elected. The problems that we're seeing with the criminal justice system right now. Well, oftentimes, we elect a mayor that might appoint a police chief. Oftentimes, sheriffs are elected. So I think just really extensive voter education would help. And also being prepared to do it and kind of understanding why it's so important. The people that we elect affect every single thing, from the smallest school boards down to your governor, up to your governor. These people affect our lives. And I think with that understanding, people will fight for the right to vote. It's a shame that they have to, but, with the proper understanding of what the significance is, I believe people will.
How can our listeners get hold of your report that's just been released, the 2016 Primaries in Review?
Sure. It's on the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law website. I think that's www.lawyerscommittee.org. And it's also on the 866 Our Vote Election Protection website, which is www.866ourvote.org. There are some interactive components if you look at it on the website. And there is also a PDF available to download and print.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us, Jennifer Patan.
Thank you.
And again, I'll be speaking with Jennifer Patan, who's a writer and editor of the Voting Rights Project of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law's latest report, the 2016 Primaries in Review, released by Election Protection, the nation's largest nonpartisan voter protection coalition. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producers Graham Fitzgibbon and Teddy Robinson. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.